The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Oncologic palliative care is presented by Dr. Kevin Hubbard.
So the concept of oncologic palliative care actually got started a few years ago when we got asked by the AOBIM, hey, how come you guys don't think that anybody in oncology ever dies of cancer? And we were developing the concept of palliative medicine and hospice, and it became its own recognized subspecialty. The whole concept at that point was that we really needed to start preparing people for board exam questions that had palliative care components to it. And so we've built some of that into pulmonary. We built some of it into cardiology. We're also making sure that we cover it with respect to oncology. So we've got that component in as well. So that's how this whole process actually got started. So we're going to talk a little bit about concepts behind palliative chemotherapy and palliative radiation therapy, and then we're going to talk about common symptoms and ways that we can manage them, things that you might get asked. And I've provided a fairly extensive review of that in the handout, but we will make sure that we put a hard target on this at 30 minutes so that Sherry can have an opportunity to come finish up her presentations, and that way we'll stay on track. So if I don't cover all of it, just be aware that all of it is available in the slide handouts. So what's this concept behind palliative chemotherapy? Why would somebody who has an advanced cancer, has a life-limiting prognosis, want to consider chemotherapy? Well, there are several reasons, but I think lots of times when we get asked these things, we find that there are several themes that emerge. The patient wants to do something, and we sort of feel like if people want to do something about something, that maybe we should find a way to partner with them. Well, there's prognostic uncertainty. You know, I've talked with Dr. A, who thinks I'm going to live 2 years. I've talked with Dr. B, who says I'd be doing good to live 3 months. And it sounds to me like we're not really sure, so maybe we should go after this. Or we've got symptoms that we think that treating these patients can offer relief from. Or we've also got a culture that promotes treating rather than the concept of doing nothing. Although if you're involved in palliative care and hospice, you know that you're actually doing a lot. You're treating symptoms, you're trying to improve quality of life, you're trying to help patients be as functional as they can for as long as they can. And gosh, that requires a lot of work. So what's this whole concept behind doing nothing? And I just don't want to sit around and whittle wood, Doc. I want to do something about this. The challenge that we have is that this is a very complex issue, and complexity involves looking at real-world situations. The reality is that we've got this teeter-totter effect, and as we see our treatment efficacy beginning to decline, we become painfully aware that on the other hand of that, our symptoms and our toxicities relatable to those treatments are going up. So we get to the point where patients have very little potential for benefit, but a whole lot of potential to feel a lot worse than they currently do as a result of the toxic effects of the therapies that we sometimes administer. So having a general concept in your mind about where we're at in that continuum, you know, if I'm looking at an exam question, is this a patient who has something that's treatable or something that's not treatable? I need to get a sense about something I could take into the exam with me that might help me think through that process. So I came up with this little diagram that I hope will be helpful to you. And it has to do with, on the one hand, looking at chemosensitive types of tumors, and then on the other hand, looking at tumors that are relatively chemo-resistant. And we kind of map these out on a continuum. So for things like germ cell carcinomas and lymphomas and leukemias, those are generally very chemosensitive types of cancers. It's more likely that we're going to get a tumor response and improve quality of life in that setting. A little bit less chemosensitive, but still very chemosensitive, would be things like ovarian and breast cancer, colorectal cancer, bladder cancer, small cell lung cancer, at least out of the box initially, tends to be a pretty chemosensitive disease. And early treatment of prostate cancer would be a fairly chemosensitive disease as well. If we move a little bit more towards the chemo-resistant side, side. Now we're into things like non-small cell lung cancer, esophageal cancer, cervical cancer, pancreatic cancer, and gastric cancer. And then to the far right, those really chemo-resistant drugs where treatment is unlikely to really offer them a whole lot in the way of a response that would affect quality of life. We've got things like melanomas and hepatocellular carcinomas, renal cell carcinomas, and some of our malignant brain gliomas would fit into that camp as well. So that has a lot to do with our thinking process. Then we also want to take a look at patients. What sort of patient population might have a lower risk for toxicity? What sort of population might have a higher risk for toxicity? And so folks that are going to do relatively well are those patients who are of younger age, maybe have a better performance status, fewer comorbidities, less prior cancer treatment, and they're relatively ambulatory. They don't have really a whole lot of prior treatment toxicity. And we've got therapies that are out there that are fairly low on the toxicity profile. So they might get some sort of targeted therapy, some of the therapies that I mentioned in the last hour, or some of those hormonal therapies that have some benefit, modest to perhaps minimal toxicities in some of that situation. Contrast that with patients who are of older age, who have worse performance status, more comorbidities that they bring with them. Maybe they've had more prior cancer treatments, and so they're weighed down from the effect of those things, or they've had prior treatment-related toxicity. Maybe they've had to have an admission to the hospital within the last 6 months for something that was relatable to toxicity. Or they're going to be getting cytotoxic chemotherapies. We typically think of cytotoxic therapies as being more toxic than some of the more targeted therapies. We've got some tools that we can use to look at performance status, and the two that are most commonly used are the Eastern Cooperative Oncology Group, or ECOG, or the more remote term, ZUBROD, performance status. And essentially, it's 0 to 4. So 0 is no symptoms at all. 1 is you've got minimal symptoms, but you're still fully functional. 2 is you're having to rest, but less than 50% of the time. 3, same situation, except now you're resting more than 50% of the time. 4 is you're pretty much bedridden at that point. We contrast that with the Karnofsky performance status scale, which you can see here, and I've kind of broken it down for how the two scales will relate. But essentially, it's very much, it goes from 100 to 0. So 100%, no symptoms at all, 90, minimal symptoms, and at 80 and 70, you start to notice increasing burdens. And then as you go through that, patients require increasing levels of care until they get to the point to where they're very sick or bedfast and essentially in the process of moribund and expected to die in a very short period of time. Well, that's a somewhat complex way. I'm a Midwesterner, so I tend to have a bent on life that I like to try to keep things simple, and I try to keep it straightforward and as pragmatic as I can, and I like to have ways that patients can relate to this. And the people that I'm training really appreciate that too. So the concept that I often rely on is what kind of patient is coming to see me in the clinic or the office that day. If this is a patient who just finished 18 holes of golf and they're coming in, particularly, they're maybe a little bit older, but they carried their own bag, they didn't use the cart, that person is probably going to do a lot better with their treatment than a person who the family is pushing in a wheelchair. The person in the wheelchair is not going to do nearly as well. They probably got more side effects. They're probably have a cancer that's affecting them more significantly, and they're confined to a bed or a chair for most of the day. So the concept is get a sense on an examination about the type of patient that you're being asked to address. Sometimes, it's like a minute, a question. I got to keep rolling here. It's a timed examination. It may be difficult to pull that out, but my encouragement to you would be to just step back and just try to get a sense over a couple of seconds about the context of the patient that you're trying to, that they're asking you about, the patient that you've been asked to address. So some general concepts to keep in mind in the heat of an examination, what can I bring with me? Well, combination agents are appropriate where chemosensitivity exists and the benefit of therapy in improving quality of life is established. It is appropriate to consider combination agents at that point. What about single agents? We've learned that more is better, but more is also more toxic. And so as a result, maybe single agents would be appropriate, particularly in those patients where their performance status is less than than 3 in the ECOG scale, and chemosensitivity exists and the benefit of therapy and quality of life improvement has been established. We might think in terms of targeted agents for those patients who have the same performance status, and we've got a biomarker that demonstrates sensitivity and there's benefit to therapy in improving overall quality of life. So we're making good informed decisions, evidence-based decisions by and large in how to approach these patients. Well, what about those patients who have a poor performance status? Generally, we recommend chemotherapy, the cytotoxic chemotherapy, be discouraged in that patient population unless there's a tumor with a known rapid response to chemotherapy. The classic example here would be somebody with a germ cell tumor or somebody with a lymphoma. Or the patient desires treatment and is accepting of the toxicity. So you've been very open, you've been very honest with them about what can be accomplished, they're willing to accept those toxicities. If they're willing to do that and their performance status is, you know, worth considering, it might be worth considering a trial of therapy. Or those patients for whom potential for improved quality of life is very real. Talk a little bit next about radiation. You know, I don't talk too much about this in internal medicine, but the reality is you may get asked a couple of radiation questions about your patients. And so there's a couple of basics that I think would be good to know. We'll just spend a couple of minutes talking about this. First of all, in higher cancer volumes are going to need higher doses of radiation for cure. The reality is that if we could administer enough radiation, we'd kill 100% of cancers that are out there. The problem is we'd also kill probably close to 100% of the patients who take it. And so it's understanding the toxicity versus what the therapy can actually provide. So if we administer 30 to 35 gray, which would be a standard treatment for bone metastases, 35 probably a little too much, but 30 gray would be pretty reasonable. We have a 60 to 70% chance of controlling subclinical disease. At 40 gray, really nobody's using definitive doses of 40 gray for most types of cancer. That's a little bit low. But we can get control of 80 to 90% of disease at that point. We get up to 50 gray. Now we're getting into doses that traditionally have been administered for things like breast cancer and non-small cell lung cancer. Admittedly, that 30 to 40 gray might be really a little bit more for lymphomas, but for solid tumors, you're gonna see benefit in more than 90% of patients who have subclinical disease. At 70 gray, you'll get control with patients who have palpable lymph nodes. At 70 to 80 gray, now if you've got tumors that are greater than 5 centimeters, you're going to take care of about 30% of that. If you go all the way up to 90 to 100 gray, 75% of primary tumors that are 5 to 15 centimeters in size are going to get control. Here's the problem, though. Normal tissue toxicity is such that you're going to have to consider that as well. So the brain is actually a pretty radiation enduring type of treatment, but at doses higher than 6,000 centigray or 60 gray, you're going to start to see brain necrosis. It makes it tough to treat the brain for any sort of longevity when you're causing brain necrosis at that point. What about the lens of the eye? Not radiation resistant at all. As little as 500 centigray, going to start to cause cataracts. The optic chiasm, pretty tough little critter, but even it, at a dose of about 5,000 to 5,500 centigray, is going to start to have blindness in a substantial percentage of the patients that you treat. Spinal cord will handle about 5,000 centigray, but at that point, you're at risk for developing paralysis with doses higher than that. If you take a look at things like the skin, pretty tough organ. It's going to handle anywhere between 5,500 to 6,000 centigray, but you're going to have to start dealing with telangiectasias, leathery skin, dry skin, and that sort of thing. Small bowel will take about 5,000 centigray, but if you go above that, now you have to deal with things like adhesions, recurrent small bowel obstructions, and all sorts of things. And so we've got this concept about how we need to dose radiation therapy. And what we need to do is to try to get to the sweet spot where we're beginning to get improvement in our control, and we get to the point where our side effects and toxicities are minimal. And the arrow right in the middle of this slide really demonstrates where we want to try to be when it comes to radiation. So that's the whole concept. So when would we think about radiation therapy? Well, for painful bony metastases is probably the most common reason. The bone's the most common metastatic site out there. 65 to 75% of men who present with advanced prostate cancer and women who present with advanced breast cancer are going to be in that group. And you're probably looking at about a third of patients with non-small cell lung cancer in that situation as well. You know, it's interesting to kind of look at this. Treatment is typically given as several fractions over a 2 to 3 week period of time. Typically, you'll hear the 30 and 10 approach. The radiation oncologist is going to administer 30 gray of radiation to a painful bony metastasis over 10 treatments. Now, here's an interesting reality. About 20 years ago, the radiation therapy oncology group got together and looked at single dose radiation, four gray administered as a single fraction versus the traditional 30 gray and 10. The same response rate was seen in terms of reduction in pain and overall quality of life. There was a slight favor for longevity of therapy in favor of the multiple fraction group, but there was really no substantial improvement in survival or any other parameter that you want to measure. The benefit to the patient is coming in and getting one treatment versus having to come back and forth every day for 2 weeks. Remember, these are patients who typically have life-limiting prognoses, and we want to try to minimize their time having to go and get treatments on a regular basis. So they went out and they interviewed bunches of oncologists, did surveys, what's the standard treatment for bone metastases prior to the study, and they actually said 30 gray and 10 fractions. The study got published. 6 months later, wound up in all the radiation oncology journals. 6 months later, they did a survey. What was the response rate? 87% of radiation oncologists in the United States said, despite the study, it's 30 gray and 10 fractions. Isn't that something? $21 million study for nothing. But the reality is that if you can minimize the number of times a patient gets to go back and forth, you're probably going to improve their quality of life. You're certainly going to have effective therapy. We can also use radiation for spinal cord compression, impending or pathologic fracture, control of massive hemoptysis and lung cancer, control of pelvic bleeding, and for brain metastases. Radiation is not valuable in a situation where death is imminent. It takes 4 to 8 weeks to see the full benefit that a course of radiation is going to provide. That's after the treatment is complete. So if you have a patient who you think is going to die within the next week or two, it's not going to be effective in that situation. You know, it's not going to be effective when it's one symptom among many. You know, I've got this, I've got that. And you all have seen these patients. They may have four or five different things they're trying to wrestle with. If it's one symptom among many, it's probably not going to be all that helpful. It's not going to be helpful if a patient can't give informed consent. It's not going to be helpful if the retreatment exceeds the normal tissue tolerance for that. So if they say, you know, patients had two courses of radiation, they've probably had their treatment tolerance. Even if you're not entirely sure whether they're at that point or not, they will probably give you a case where it's abundantly clear and you can use your judgment in that situation to say that radiation is not likely to be effective because of that. Or what about a therapy facility is unavailable? Well, obviously you can't get it, so it becomes difficult to even think about offering it at that particular point. Well, we've got about 12 or 13 minutes left, and so what I want to do is kind of get into these symptoms a little bit that you may be asked to deal with. So let's talk first about nausea and vomiting. It affects about 60% of all terminal cancer patients. 40% of that's going to be within the next 6 weeks of life. 71% of patients who are admitted to hospitals, I know that numbers of us do hospital medicine, chances are pretty good that this is a real common theme on your service. You've got patients admitted who have advanced cancers and they just need to have their symptoms controlled. So for the history, what you want to try to do is to focus on the character of the nausea and vomiting. You want to focus on associated symptoms. What makes it better? What makes it worse? Get a list of medications as well as the history and how are they taking those medications. Look at their prior therapies. Look at their past medical history as well. And then think about some of these things. We know that chemical abnormalities can affect about 31% of patients who are having trouble with nausea and vomiting. Here we think about electrolyte abnormalities, acidosis, alkalosis, infection can be a component of that as well. 44% of these patients can have impaired gastric emptying. A lot of them are on narcotics, and we know that narcotics can slow GI motility. We have patients who have visceral or serosal cancers, 31% of these. They can have bowel obstruction, gastrointestinal bleeding, peptic ulcer disease, enteritis, constipation, the whole thing really factors into this. Medications, 51%, half of all patients who get admitted for nausea and vomiting are going to have medications as the culprit. When medications are the culprit, 83% of the time it's the opioids that they're taking. The best way to control nausea and vomiting is to really have a concept of the pathways of nausea and vomiting that are involved. And so this kind of goes back a little bit to school and may go back to residency a little bit. So you want to think about those four pathways that get involved. In a situation like this, you want to think about the cerebral cortex. You want to think about the chemoreceptor trigger zone. Think about the vestibular apparatus. A lot of this has to do with instability. And then also remember the gastrointestinal tract has its own receptors. And so as a result of that, we kind of see all of that coming together at the vomiting center and ultimately the stimulus to have nausea and vomiting gets kicked off. So we've got some neurotransmitters that we want to consider. Four areas that we think about: serotonin, dopamine, acetylcholine, and histamine factors into that as well. So ways that we might address that is to look at how we're going to approach it. We want to think about this mechanistically. Careful assessments to determine the etiology. If I think it's medications, the question is, are the medications I can set free so that we don't have to worry about those medications causing nausea and vomiting? Think about that possibility. Use the knowledge that we have of the pathophysiology to determine the receptors and their underlying symptoms. And then we want to choose an effective antiemetic to block those appropriate receptors. It really is a little bit more complicated than everybody gets Zofran. And even though Zofran's great, I certainly use a lot of it, it's really designed for chemotherapy-induced nausea or vomiting. So if it's a patient that hasn't had chemotherapy for a while, it may not be quite as efficacious. It's, you know, essentially it's just a big fancy antihistamine. It's a great drug, but maybe there might be other drugs, if we understand this mechanistically, that could work better. Now, rather than sit here and give you an exhaustive list, if I were going to take about 8 to 10 drugs into my board exam, what would I take with me? Well, I would take some knowledge of some of these medications. Metoclopramide, we don't use too much for nausea and vomiting anymore. We know that it has some pretty significant extrapyramidal effects, so we have to be careful. But in those patients who have gastroparesis, low-dose metoclopramide may be effective. It works on D2 receptors, particularly in the gastrointestinal tract, and may help. Haloperidol, we sort of rediscovered Haldol as an antiemetic. There is always an anxiety component. When you think about the last time you were nauseated, you probably felt a little anxious about it. So it's an anxiolytic in some respects, but it also, because it's banging in that dopaminergic receptors in the chemoreceptor trigger zone, minimizes nausea and vomiting. We've got other drugs that we've known about for some time that do that. Prochlorperazine and chlorpromazine. Thorazine's wonderful. It helps in a lot of different areas. Promethazine, Finergan, has been effective. It's primarily going to work on acetylcholine and some histamine receptors. Diphenhydramine, good old-fashioned Benadryl, works on histamine receptors as well. We also have some drugs that work on acetylcholine receptors. Here, think about atropine, scopolamine primarily. And then I've mentioned ondansetron and mirtazapine. They work on 5-hydroxytryptamine 3 receptors. As far as non-pharmacologic therapy goes, you know, there's a lot of things that you can do to help these people. Avoid strong smells or other triggers, perfumes and cologne. Oncology nurses for years have sort of worked under the reality that they can't really perfume up a whole lot. They can't really wear a lot of colognes or aftershaves, because if they do, they may have patients who are nauseated and vomiting. And when the food trays come in, they're always covered. We don't open that until the patient is ready to eat. Think about small, frequent meals instead of three big, large ones. So sometimes just nibbling a little bit can help. Think about limiting oral intake during severe episodes. You know, you really just want to let your gut be your guide in a situation like that. Relaxation techniques, acupuncture and acupressure wristbands, all of these things have demonstrated some efficacy in terms of managing this. We'll talk next about dyspnea. This is going to affect 50 to 70% of cancer patients with a life-limiting illness. There are a lot of things that can cause dyspnea. And here, think about concomitant lung disease, deconditioning. Most of these patients have not been feeling well for a while. They were probably out of shape when they came in initially, and because of their malignancy, they've even deconditioned from the point when they initially presented. Cachexia factors into that, pleural effusions, and obstruction from tumor. This can be a real problem. You can develop atelectasis, or you can have patients who will literally obliterate part of the blood supply to the lung, and as a result of that, the pulmonary arteries are no longer effective in turning over oxygen and carbon dioxide in that lung. So they've had a functional lobectomy or a functional pneumonectomy in a situation like that. Also, lymphangitic metastases. These can cause a restrictive-like process within the lung itself. You'll notice pan-inspiratory rales on deep inspiration, ways that you can pick those things up. So to recognize the symptoms, it's important to realize that the only reliable way to identify this is patient self-reporting. There's no blood test or sort of metric that we can look for to tell us whether or not a patient is dyspneic. This is really good old-fashioned patient self-reporting. You can certainly look at things like respiratory rate, PO2, their oxygen saturation. Those things may guide your therapy, but they really don't correlate consistently with the symptoms of dyspnea. So you want to focus on identification and treatment of the underlying cause. If I were to ask a board question about patients with advanced cancer and dyspnea, this would probably be the area that I would tend to focus on. So this is an important concept that there's no blood test, there's no real measure of this. Patient self-reporting is really the most important tool that we have. Potential causes and potential treatments. If it's an airway obstruction, we might be able to do a stent, a laser, radiation therapy to the tumor. Would it be reasonable to resect the tumor? Well, I think if your patients have got good enough performance status and is willing to undergo the procedure, it is certainly reasonable to consider that. Steroids or chemotherapy can also be considered as appropriate tools to treat that process. If they're obstructed from COPD, bronchodilators and steroids, bring those to the table and give those a trial, see if maybe they will be effective. What about those patients who have pneumonia? Well, of course, antibiotic therapy and all the other things that we do, chest physical therapy and bronchodilators and nebulizer treatments, those would all be appropriate in a situation like this. For those patients who are dyspneic from heart failure, diuretics and things that you can do to decrease afterload, all of those tools that you traditionally would use would be very helpful. What about treatment-related pneumonitis? Some of these patients can have problems with that. Glucocorticoids are the drug of choice to consider in that situation. Sometimes you'll have patients, maybe they don't necessarily have a pulmonary problem, but they have an intra-abdominal malignancy and they've got massive ascites and their diaphragmatic excursion has been compromised. Drainage and diuretics can help in that situation. If they're anemic, a trial of transfusion is certainly reasonable. If we have patients who have malignant pleural effusions, one of the things that we could consider is a thoracentesis. And if patients get benefit from that, if it looks like we're going to have to deal with a thoracentesis on a regular basis, we could consider one of two options. One would be what's a little gizmo called a Plurex catheter. It's an indwelling catheter. It's inserted, and in our place, we have the interventional radiologist inserted, but pulmonary folks, chest surgeons, there's a wide variety of people who are available to us that would put in this device, and we teach the family how to drain this periodically. And so for patients who want long-term management, that's certainly a reasonable option. For those patients who maybe aren't real fired up about having an indwelling catheter in, there's always a consideration for pleurodesis. And in many cases, that can be done through a thoracoscope, so you don't have to undergo a big open procedure. You can just have a somewhat limited procedure, use a talc, or in certain cases, intrapleural chemotherapy, although I think more recently, I've seen intrapleural chemotherapy used with less and less frequently, more commonly now that we're using talc in that situation, at least in our neck of the woods. The good news about opioids is that the lung has opioid receptors within it, and so we've learned that opioid treatment can offer us a very effective adjunct to manage dyspnea. It can improve the sensation of breathlessness, has both central and peripheral action. Oxygen, of course, can be a very powerful component, and it's a very powerful symbol of medical care. You know, you come in, and here's your loved one, and they're on oxygen. Well, you know, it sounds like we certainly are trying to do everything we can to help. Now, the reality is that when we've compared oxygen to just having a fan or an open window in the room, it works just as well. But be careful of your patients who maybe are suffering with allergies, or if you're working in the city, sometimes some of the stuff that normally hangs around in our big cities, that particulate matter may cause an increase in their symptoms. And so having an open window may not be quite as effective in that situation. You also have to be careful, of course, with CO2 retainers, and so you want to monitor them appropriately to make sure that you don't get into trouble. I'm going to talk just briefly about depression and anxiety because I do think it's important that we underscore a couple of things. If we look at the prevalence of anxiety in terminally ill patients, we'll find that it's about 6 to 8% of the cancer population. If we look at the community elderly, it's about 2 to 10% of the population. In nursing home residents, it's pretty high. It's about 10% of the nursing home population is anxious. But boy, doggone it, if you're looking at those patients who are admitted to palliative care and hospice, the degree of anxiety can be as high as 60 to 70% in that patient population. So if you have those patients who are admitted to an inpatient palliative care unit, something to think about. If you look at depression, it's 14 to 31% of patients who have cancer. But only about 2% in the community elderly who have suffered from a CVA. Nursing home residents is going to be about 10 to 25%. But interestingly enough, the incidence of depression in palliative care and hospice patients is only about 14, 15%. So it's not quite as high as you might think. So think about that patient population and how that might play into this. One point I do want to make in terms of managing depression are the numbers of drugs that can cause depression. And I will cover this in one more slide, and then I'll conclude with this presentation. So medications that can cause depression, things like steroids, interferons, interleukin-2, tyrosine kinase inhibitors, zidovudine, and vinblastine are major consideration. So if you're looking for a quick screening tool, this is just kind of a take-home. This may or may not show up on the board exam, but I think this is a really handy take-home for you guys. There's a two-question screening tool that has demonstrated 97% sensitivity and 67% specificity for the presence of depression. First question is, during the past month, have you been bothered by feeling down, depressed, or hopeless? The second question is, during the past month, have you been bothered by little interest or pleasure in doing things? That can be two very effective tools, very good screening tools. End of life at sensitivity and specificity appear to drop a little bit, but pretty good screening tool that you can use. Now, if I were to ask a room full of my colleagues who are preparing for a board examination, have you been bothered by feeling down, depressed, or hopeless? You'd probably all say yes. But the question is not so much, have you felt that way? Well, yeah, you know, momentarily, I suppose. But the real thing is to this, have you been bothered by that? Has this had an impact? But I think most of us are going to go, well, I may not want to take the bloody exam, but I'll go do it because I know I need to. So you find a way to work through that. These people are really struggling with that.